Okay, so let's see what what we have here. Okay. Okay, so the question is, who, what were you in your past life? Okay. Yeah. Interesting question, isn't it? I think sometimes you can actually know quite a bit about your past life just by knowing who you are in this life. Just by looking at your character and knowing who you are, you don't actually have to remember your past life so much. Sometimes just by knowing who you are as a person, you can actually have quite a bit of idea about what you were in the past life. And one of the things that always amazes me is how I ended up as a Buddhist monk. It's quite astonishing when you think about it. I grew up in Norway, to a large part, also a little bit in the UK and other countries, but to a large part in Norway. I didn't have any Buddhist friends, I didn't have any Asian friends, my parents weren't Buddhist, and yet somehow I kind of got sidetracked into becoming a Buddhist and ending up as a monk. And the only way I can really explain that is by postulating or thinking or assuming that I was a Buddhist in a past life. So my reckoning is that I was probably some Asian person in a past life. I was probably, Chinese or something like that. But that's my guess. That's the best I can do for, my past life. And the point is that whatever character traits that you have in this life, whatever things that are very deeply ingrained in you, certain traits, certain behavior patterns, whatever it is, it's very likely that's exactly the kind of person you were in a past life. You just carry these things, you carry them with you from one life to the next one. And this is really what is important. It doesn't matter so much what what you were in terms of specifics. What matters is the character that you bring with you from life to life. And that is quite, in a sense, it's quite challenging and frightening to think about that. We had a person in Perth recently. We have one man who's part of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia in Perth. And he does these things called past life regressions. You heard about past life regressions? Mm-hmm. Heard about that? Yeah. So basically the idea is that you hypnotize somebody, and then you suggest to them to remember their past lives. And this is something that's done by many, many people around the world. And often the results are very kind of iffy. They remember all kinds of strange things. Sometimes it's very unreliable and very not very good. But occasionally you have somebody who actually remembers things that are very specific, like a name or a place or a house or, their relationships or where the shape of the house, the color of the house, the job they had and all these kind of things. And there was one man who was part of our Buddhist society who was hypnotized, and he remembered enormous amounts of details from his past life. Exactly these kind of things, his own name. The name of his wife, the name of his children, how many children he had, where he lived, what his house looked like, what kind of job he had, all these kind of things, right? And once you have a large amount of details, of factual details, together like that, you can actually check it against the records, right? You can see whether such a person actually existed. And of course, what he did, he went into the Western Australian records of people who had, he had been a migrant, according to memory, from Ireland about 120 years before, or something like that. And he checked the records, and it turns out that there was such a person with such a name who married such a woman. And all the details, except for a few, kind of just checked out one after the other. And he was a Catholic, he didn't want to believe in rebirth, right? He thought, But after a while, he realized there was just no other explanation. He had to, this is basically, it was too many things that fell into place, statistically speaking. Probability-wise, it was almost impossible that it could have been a coincidence. There was too many things. So after a few months of reflecting on this and trying to come to terms with the consequence of this, it was no other choice. And what happened, he said, what was so powerful about this is that what happened was that he then realized that many of the character traits that he had in this life, they were just the same as the character traits he had in the past life. He was a businessman, he had his own he had started a company. He was one of these entrepreneurs in Australia, and he was selling some equipment to the mining industry. And he was very proud of his business. He built it up from scratch, like people do, this kind of people. And he was going to sell some very big equipment to the you know, talking about multi-million-dollar contracts with a large, very large mining firms in Western Australia. And he was very excited about this, and he thought, yeah, build this up, you know, really, this is, you know, and I, you know, feeling that this was kind of his baby and his job and his life to build this thing up. And he had recently had married, had a wife, and they were expecting a child and all this kind of thing. But then he realized that actually this drive to establish a business, this drive to work hard and get things going, it wasn't his free choice, because he had been exactly the same kind of character in the past life. In the past life, he had come from as a migrant from Ireland. He had established a farm in Australia, built up a farm, and he was very proud of his farm. It was his life's work, right? So he was one of these doers, who actually, this was just part of his character. And suddenly he realized, instead of this being his free choice, instead of being proud of this, he was trapped. He wasn't a trap. He was just following all patterns, all habit patterns from a past life. It wasn't actually he who wanted to do this. It was just the habit that was running him. He wasn't running the show. The habits were running the show. The past life, his character was running the show. And then he got this aversion against running the business, right? He didn't want to do it anymore. He said, oh, I've got to get rid of this. Because he felt it was a trap rather than a matter of free choice. And this is the interesting thing about it. This is why I was saying before about the idea of past lives, why it is so scary when you think about the consequences of past lives. When you understand that actually you are trapped by these things, you are driven by these things, you have just these habits, and the habits are running you rather than you running the habits. You realize that, you are stuck, so to speak, And this is scary, because then you start to feel that you want to rebel against this rather than actually just be trapped by these things. And then when you start to rebel, and this is, when I think about my own character traits, you go back, what it's like when you go, I've just been back visiting my parents in Norway, and when you go back and visit your close family, all the old habits, they tend to come back again, right? All the same things that have always been there, all the things come up. But I realize I don't want to be trapped by these habits. I don't want to be triggered by the same thing that triggered me 30 years ago when my parents say A, I react with B, and then they react with C, and it's kind of this pattern which kind of, works itself out. I don't want to be trapped by that. Once you realize it's a trap, you actually start to get more mindfulness, and you start to rebel, and you start to counteract those things, and you're actually able to give up some of those habits from the past. This is what happened with this man in Australia. This is what happened with me, because I realized the importance of this. And he said what he wanted to do was to become a monk at that stage, but he was already married. His wife was expecting a child, so it was a bit too late. another trap, right? In family life, another trap. So trap upon trap. But this is the power of understanding right view. This is why right view is so important. If you understand the consequences of it, it has a very powerful, can be a very powerful drive in your life to push you on the spiritual path. That's why it actually matters. So don't worry so much about whether you were an ant in a past life or a horse or a Martian or a British or a Finnish or whatever. It doesn't really matter so much. What matters is to understand these kind of big patterns that are actually working out there. That's what actually matters. Okay. Gee, that's going to take a long time. I can try to go a bit faster, see what the next one says. Okay, dear Ajahn, sometimes in my meditation I see green and purple lights. They are never stable, appear and disappear. Those can't be nimittas, because I'm at the stage of present moment awareness with at least a little bit of thinking. What are these lights and what to do with them? Thank you. Megametta, okay. Okay, so sometimes lights, there are many, many reasons why lights, you can see lights in a meditation practice. And only one of the reasons is when your meditation becomes very profound and very deep. And this is what we call nimittas usually. And if it is a real meditation nimitta, it is usually conjoined with lots of piti, with lots of joy, with lots of peace and all these other things. So if you find that you have a lot of happiness, a lot of joy, and the mind is very peaceful, and as you say, if there's a bit of thinking there, it's unlikely to be the nimittas. But the more powerful all these good qualities are, the more likely it is that it's a real samadhi nimitta. The kind of nimitta means, in Pali, it means like, you can't translate it as an object, basically. It's just something that you, it's like a visual impression in the mind, is how it's often used. But in meditation practice, it's used as a stable image that's always there, very simple, like a light in the meditation practice. So that's one possibility. And it can be, sometimes what happens is that these nimittas can be very weak in the beginning, something very fuzzy, something like a cloudy kind of thing, something which isn't very strong. And that weak nimitta can exist with a mind state which isn't all that profound. But very often, people are very different, and some people have very visual minds. And the visual mind will often be able to see things, even though the meditation isn't very profound. You can see colors, you can see all kinds of things. Don't worry too much about it. If you're unsure whether it's a nimitta, it probably isn't, because you'll probably know if it actually was one. So just stay with the meditation object. If you want to focus on those lights, see what happens, you can do that. You can focus on the colors to see if that maybe can take you deeper. That's a possibility. Or if you prefer to watch the breath, just go back with the breath or go back to the metta meditation. Don't worry too much about those things. But you can, if it's good fun, you can play around a little bit with these kind of things. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, I feel that my girlfriend's lack of Dhamma is a hindrance to both my own practice and our relationship. Unequal levels of spiritual development make the companionship feel unbalanced. How do I proceed? How do I help her to find the Dhamma? Okay. It's always very difficult to make other people see the light, right? You see the light, this is it, I found. And sometimes the problem is that we are deluded ourselves. You think that you've found the real path in life, and a few years go by, and then it's actually it wasn't like great after all, That's often what happens. So sometimes you think that you've found the Dhamma, and actually, maybe you haven't found the Dhamma. Maybe it isn't really you. Maybe it's just that you are going to an inspired stage where you think everything is great. Just like when you fall in love, you thought, wow, you found the girl or the man of your life, and then a few years later you're divorced again and you had it. Same thing with the Dhamma. You married to the Dhamma and then you divorce later on. So don't be too, sometimes there's too many uncertainties there. But of course, it could be the case that you really are inspired by the Dhamma in a profound and real way. And the most important thing, and this is what I found in my relationship with my parents and my family, is not to push these things. Don't try to convert somebody. Don't tell them, this is it, you must listen to what I have to say because I understand that. That usually makes people more resistant and they will push back and they don't want to listen to what you have to say. So don't try to convert somebody else. What you should do instead, and this is what I did with my parents and my family, and it had an incredible effect on my parents. Don't do anything at all. Don't say anything. Don't convert them. Just be with them. Just be kind. And show that this Dhamma has an effect on you. That it actually makes you better. It makes you more gentle, more kind, more caring for the other person. And if you can show through your actions that you are improving as a person, then the other person is likely to listen to what you have to say. This is one way, and there are other ways, there are kind of tricky ways you can use it. I know that this is my teacher, Ajahn Brahm. He says that what you should do, if you have a husband or wife who doesn't want to learn a Dhamma, you should have a Dhamma book in the house, and you should put it on the table. It's like a nice Dhamma book, right? And you should tell your wife and husband, never touch that book. That's my book, you're not allowed to read this book. So you should start here. And if you say that, they will say, oh, this is interesting. And then when you sneak out of the house, they will take a look at the Dhamma book, right? So this is one very, very naughty way people do things. But sometimes you can just do that, right? You can just have a Dhamma book around the house, maybe a nice Dhamma book. And one day, if they are interested, they might pick it up and they might read something. And don't give them something too heavy. Give them something very light, something very easy. you know, some book which is kind of just some story, something simple to give them access to the Dhamma. This is one of the great things about my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, is the way he teaches the Dhamma. He teaches mostly through stories and through jokes. He likes to tell jokes. And so when you read his books, you don't really get a very religious feel at all. All you get is this feeling that, you know, there's some nice stories there with some spiritual meaning here. And once people see that this is what Buddhism is about, it's not really so much a religion, it's more like a way of life. It's a way of dealing with ordinary life, basically. Everybody wants to be able to deal with life, right? We all want to be wise, we all want to be able to deal with problems and to move towards happiness. And once people understand that this is what it's about, then it's very easy for them, more easy anyway, for them to open up to that possibility. Okay. Okay, why did you decide to be a monk? Yeah, I told you already, because in the past life, right? That's the reason. The way it looks like in this life, if I just disregard the past life, then what it looks like is that when I was in my early 20s, I went to Japan. I was a student in Norway at the time, and they had this exchange program, and I got a chance to go to Japan. And that was my first meeting with Buddhism when I was there. I went to the Buddhist temples, I read my first Buddhist book. And there was something familiar about it. It's very strange, isn't it? You come to these things and you think, there's something about this which seems right, almost. But that wasn't the main thing. The most important thing was when I got back to Norway again. And when my best friend at the time, he had a book on meditation, and he told me, you must read this. And he gave me this book on meditation practice. And I tried that. I tried it out, and I had some good results. And that was the most important thing for me, because once you feel that these things have a certain value, that they actually work. And whenever in your life, later on I was studying again in London later on, and I wasn't really having a very good time. I was studying finance, and I don't know how I got into that, but anyway I was. And I realized that I don't really want to do this. This is stupid. You know, the kind of the wrong kind of people. I'm not really interested in what these people are interested in. And I thought back to my time when I was meditating, and I thought, that's what I really want to do. And funnily enough, when you see kind of the suffering in life, then you start to think about how you should lead your life. And that's when I first went to a monastery in England called Chitra's Monastery. That's where I started out. later on, I moved on to Australia. When I heard a talk by Ajahn Brahm, I moved on to Australia later on. This is it. I think this is the most important thing, is that, you know, you have some kind of positive experience with the Buddhist teachings and meditation. That's what really matters. If you have some positive experience with it, it will sustain you, it will carry you along. And you'll be able to do this for a very long time in the future. And that's why I say, make sure that you enjoy your meditation practice. Make sure you have a good time. If you have a good time, then this is going to sustain you. The other thing which is important to sustain you for the long term, when I was quite a young monk, I asked another very senior monk, he was from New Zealand actually, very, very nice, very gentle, very nice monk from New Zealand. I asked him, if I want to be a monk for a long time, if I want to get success in this monastic life, do you have some kind of recommendation? What should I do to ensure the long-term success in monastic life? And he said, the most important thing you can do is to read the suttas. Read the word of the Buddha, that will sustain you. Because if you have that foundation, if you have a basic understanding of what this is all about, it will carry you through any difficulties, right? Any difficult times, it will carry you through, and you will come out the other side as a better person. And it's true, right? I mean, if all you have is you meditate, that's all you have in your spiritual life, then once meditation doesn't really work anymore, it stops. Meditation is a bit like this. Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't go well, right? Up and down. If you don't have something more to sustain you, to take you through the difficult patches, then you might give up when it goes down. But actually, what you should do when it goes down, you should start investigating. Why is it going down? And by investigating, you can learn something about yourself. You can learn something about the defilements of the mind. And this will propel you up again and even higher next time around. And in this way, you have this slope, which is a general leading upwards, like this. Even though it goes up and down as you go up, the general trend of the slope is going up. And that is what matters there. Yeah, okay. How can you tell the difference between focusing and grasping at peace and stillness? Okay, so how do you tell the difference between focusing and grasping? Okay, the main, when you start to grasp, you start to feel, you don't feel relaxed anymore. Yeah? You start to feel slightly tight, slightly tense. This is the main way you can tell the difference. So if you are relaxed all the time, you are usually not grasping. Yeah? Grasping means a certain amount of tension inside of you. Yeah? So this is how you, this is why I always start, that's why you start off every meditation by just relaxing, just feeling really at ease. And then you don't go out and grasp the breath or hold on to the breath. Instead you wait for the breath to come to you, right? This is the same idea. When you wait for the breath to come to you, there's no grasping happening at all. So you wait and you wait, and when the breath comes, well there it is. So then you are meditating on the breath. And then the breath disappears, and when the breath disappears, you don't go back grasping the breath and pulling it back in again. You just wait. You wait for the breath to come by itself. And by doing it this way, there's very little force, very little willpower, very little grasping. And the way it feels inside of you, you feel relaxed, you feel at ease. You don't, you know, the breath comes by itself quite naturally. There's no kind of sense of tension in the breath or anything like that. This is how you know that you are roughly on the right track. Of course, this is the ideal situation. Nothing is really ever that ideal, so you try to approximate that. That's what roughly how I would go about those things. How to build a more heart or healthy centered relationship to Dhamma? Heart centered relationship to Dhamma? Heart. Okay, so I take it to mean heart. So, how do you develop a more heart centered relationship to Dhamma? That's a very good question. I think it's a very important question. I think sometimes for some practitioners it can be like a very cold relationship. You don't really feel any emotions about the Dhamma. You don't have any kind of relationship with the Buddha as a person. You don't have that kind of sense of devotion. In other words, you don't talk about devotion, right? Now, I got quite an interesting question a while ago. We have a forum page maybe it was a private mail, I can't remember now what it was. Anyway, but somebody from Turkey. It's amazing. This is one of the nice things about being a Buddhist monk. You get all these letters from people around the world asking you questions. Turkey, right? Previously I got people from Egypt asking me questions. We have a Pakistani man who is a Buddhist who had to flee Pakistan because he got hounded out of Pakistan after becoming a Buddhist. It's amazing. Yeah. But anyway, you get all these people around the world, which is great. And he asked me the question, well, you know, I used to be part of this Hindu spiritual group called the Ananda Magga or something like that, the path of bliss, what that means. And he said that part of the Hindu spiritual path is this idea of bhakti. Bhakti means devotion. And he said that the beautiful thing about this is like you have this relationship with a god, right? Maybe Brahma in the Hindu tradition. And you have this devotional aspect to a god. And you can have that in Christianity as well, right? Or Islam. And because it is a devotional aspect, there's a heart connection there with this God. You know, wow, this God is so amazing. He created this universe or whatever. And that creates a heart connection to the God. And it creates devotion. That can create happiness and all these kind of things. Then he said, I decided that the philosophy of Hinduism wasn't really satisfactory, so I had to give it up. But now I have a hard time finding that devotion in Buddhism. Is there a devotional aspect to Buddhism as well? And again, that's a very similar kind of question to this one. And the reality is that, yes, there is a similar kind of thing in the Buddhist teachings, and it's very important to be able to tap into that. As I was reading out this morning the sutta about the different stages of happiness that you go through. Now this happiness is driven by a number of things can drive this kind of happiness. I was talking about virtue this morning. If you're really virtuous, you will get that kind of happiness and the meditation will go. If you are a very generous kind of character, that will come by itself and it will give rise to happiness. But other kind of traditional ways of giving rise to that joy in the meditation is one is called the Buddha Nusati. It's a recollection of the Buddha. One is Dhamma Nusati, recollection of the Dhamma. Sangha Nusati, recollection of the Sangha. So these are basically like devotional practices towards the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. So how do you have a devotional practice towards the Buddha? What does that mean? Well, what it means is to try to get your mind around what it means to be a Buddha. What actually is it to be a Buddha? And once you understand the profundity of the Buddha's awakening here, to understand the profundity of the qualities that make up a Buddha, that's when the devotion starts to awaken in you. So you can maybe, one way of doing it is to think of the most remarkable person you can think of in this life, right? Somebody with really amazing qualities. I don't know. Maybe somebody like Gandhi, because Gandhi is also an Indian, right? So it kind of helps me a bit. Think about Gandhi. Think about this man who kind of wandered around, right? Getting people together. He was basically trying to throw the British out of India. That's what he was trying to do. And he was doing it for year after year, decade. He went on for a long time. I'm not sure how long he went on for. But it was always through peace, right? It was no violence. He was so extremely committed to non-violence all the way through. That takes incredible personal integrity. And there are lots of stories about Gandhi that are very, very impressive. There's one story that, again, Ajahn Brahm told me this story. And this is a story where Gandhi was living in England. And he was a student in England. And he was living in with a landlady. And this landlady had a son. And one day, this landlady goes to Gandhi and she says to Gandhi, "Well, Gandhi, you have a lot of influence on my son. He really looks up to you. So could you please go to him and tell him to stop eating sugar? Because he eats too much sugar, right?" And then, the days went by and a couple of weeks went by. Nothing happened. And eventually, Gandhi does what she says, and she goes to the son and says, maybe it's a good idea to reduce the sugar a little bit, whatever. And then the landlady goes and says, "Well, why did it take you, 2 or 3 weeks to tell my son? When did you do it so straight away?" And he said that, "Well, I had to give up sugar first myself before I could ask the person to do it." Right? That's integrity for you, right? There's a very deep kind of integrity here, and this is. When you think about a person like that, somebody who's very wise, somebody who has a lot of integrity, very moral, very kind, very soft, all these things. And then the Buddha, you can start to get a feeling for what the Buddha is. The Buddha is even more like that, right? Even more powerful, even more wisdom. One great way of coming to understand the Buddha is to read the suttas, and to read the word of the Buddha and see the power of that word, be inspired by that. This is a great way of gaining some faith and confidence in the Buddha. And the way I like to think about the Buddha is I like to see him as, there's two qualities in the Buddha which I find very easily go together. One is the wisdom aspect. Somebody who has understood the human condition all the way down to the core. He understands what it's like to be human. He understands suffering and happiness, right? He understands exactly what we want as human beings. That's what he understands. He has the fullest and deepest understanding of that. And that is obviously worthy of tremendous respect, because anyone, whoever we respect in this world, are usually people who can actually give us what we want, or who have some ability to help us in a certain way. These are the people we respect. If you think about the people in your life who have been important to you, who have done something good for you in your life, people you have gone to when you have a problem or something, they are people often who can help you solve your problems, right? You go to a nice uncle or a nice aunt who, when you have a problem, and they help you out. Now, these are the important people because they can help us. And the Buddha has the most deepest understanding of the human condition, the most profound understanding, and is therefore worthy of the highest respect for that reason, much more than any problems that can be solved by ordinary people. So this is the wisdom aspect of the Buddha. And the second aspect is the compassion aspect, right? Remember the Buddha, after his awakening, he was finished. He had done what he had to do. There was nothing more for him to do. And the only reason why he continued on with his life for another 45 years after his awakening was because of other people. That was the absolutely only reason. His entire motivation for all the teachings he gave, everything he did for 45 years, every act he did was motivated by one thing: compassion, nothing else. So if you think about the Buddha, he's almost like the he's like an incarnation of wisdom and compassion. That's all he is, wisdom and compassion, right? He's a walking wisdom and compassion in a walking form, basically. That's what he is. And when you start to get your head around that, you start to think about that, there's something very powerful and extraordinarily beautiful about that. And then you start to get the feeling for the Buddha by reading the suttas, and you start to see some live example, perhaps in the present day. There still are monks and nuns in the world who are very inspiring. There are some lay people around in the world, Buddhists, who are very inspiring. And when you see inspiring examples who have practiced the path a long way, that also inspires you, because again, you get a little bit of feeling for what this is all about. So this is how you can develop devotion and you can develop a heart connection with Dhamma. It's very important, and it's a very good point. We should have had a little Buddha statue here. Next time, it would be great if you can bring a Buddha statue here, because that brings a little bit of the feeling of a connection with the Buddha. Because when you see the Buddha statue, I like to bow down to a Buddha statue, because what I bow down to is not the statue. What I bow down to is the qualities of the Buddha, right? I bow down to wisdom, compassion, peace, kindness. And isn't that worth bowing down to? When you bow down to that with a sincere heart, it feels good. You feel really happy about that. It feels right. So this is, it's a little bit of you can call it worship if you like, but it's worshipping something very worthwhile, worshipping in this world. And we need something like that to look up to, something very positive to look up to. It kind of carries you forward, and it does something very good for you. So it's actually quite nice to bow down to something worthy, something worthy of respect in that way. And you can have a similar attitude also to the Sangha and to the Dhamma as well, because the Dhamma and the Sangha, they are just functions of the Buddha, really. They kind of come once the Buddha is there. You can think about the Dhamma, the qualities of the Dhamma, how it carries you forward, how it is, how you can, attain these things right here and right now, all these kind of things you can think of. Okay, wow, it's already past 5. Okay. What shall we do? I don't want to kind of hold people back. Shall we continue with the questions, or do people do we have to leave by 5, or what is it like? No, shall we go on? What I suggest, I'm quite happy to go on, but what I suggest maybe is that I can, if anybody needs to go, please feel free to leave at any time you want to go. There's no obligation to stay behind. And those who want to stay behind and listen to the rest, please do so. Is that a good way of doing it? Yeah? Okay. So we'll do that way then. And I'll continue maybe for another half an hour, 25 minutes or something. We'll see how far we get. Okay. Dear Ajahn, could you please give a brief update as to how the monastery and nunnery is progressing? Thank you. Okay. So this is about the situation in Perth, presumably, how things are going in Perth, the monastery in Perth. The situation there is that it's going very well. It's a very, very popular monastery. Lots of people want to ordain down there. We have a long, very long waiting list of people who want to ordain in Perth. So we're trying to build more huts to get everybody, all the monks and things, in there. Which is great, right? You feel that there's interest. There's always a very positive feeling about that. And the nuns' monastery is going really, really well. They are in the middle of a very large building program to build a large hall and all these kind of things. So they have just collected over $3 million building program they're doing, a very large one. And once they've done that, they will have room for about 20 nuns or something in the nuns' monastery. So if you're interested, this is your chance. I think, I'm not sure if they probably also have a long waiting list, actually. I'm not sure what it is like, but it's very, the nuns' monastery in Perth is very nice. Did you go to nuns' monastery in Perth, Richard?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
You haven't seen it? No. Okay. Yes. The nuns' monastery is very nice. It's a very large property. Yeah. It's, in terms of hectares, do you work in hectares in Finland? Is that what you are? So it would be about 250 hectares, something like that. So it's a large property, 2 by 1 kilometre large, And so it's very nice because it means that when you are on that property, you feel like you're really separated from the rest of the world, right? You're far away. You're kind of really independent of the world around you. And that's despite the fact it's only about 40 minutes drive from Perth, and Perth is quite a large city here. So, things are going very, very well in Perth. Okay. How am I able to achieve anything without any willpower? For example, in sports. Okay, are you sure you want to achieve anything in sports? Okay. to achieve something in sports, maybe you probably need quite a bit of willpower, probably helpful. But even in sports, it is one of the things that we find is that some of the best sports people around the world, when they are really good, they often don't use too much willpower. It's when things happen naturally that they often achieve their best. And I don't know if sometimes when Tiger Woods, for example, now he's kind of a bit of a fallen star, but when at his best, you know, he said that at his best a few years ago, he said that the best at his best when he really was playing really well at golf. Golf is a bit different from other sports. He said that it's almost as if you just flow along, right? It's a natural flow. There's no willpower there. And things just flow automatically. You hit the golf ball, and things just flow kind of nicely. And this is a bit like meditation practice. It's when you get this self out of the way. When you get the feeling that you are in the driver's seat, and you get rid of that feeling that you are driving this thing, that's when things start to flow by themselves. This is actually a term that they use in sport, is this idea of flow, when things just flow automatically, and you're not driving it so much. So even in, I think, and this is what tends to happen, that even in sports, if you are a good meditator, if you have the ability to let go, if you have the ability to let things kind of go on their own, you actually you have more success in even in sports, so it seems. So there isn't, I don't think there is any contradiction here. It's just that you, things actually tend to go more naturally once you get the willpower out of the way. Okay. Dear Ajahn, could you please elaborate on what you mean when you say the body becomes not that important in the meditation practice? Okay. To me, that expression has a flavor of denying the body, but I guess that is not what you mean. Thank you. Yeah, what I mean is that it's not denying the body. What I mean is that when you sit there and you feel the body, usually the reason why we feel the body is for two reasons. Either because the body gives pleasure, right? If you're eating something nice, your attention goes to the mouth, to the food. It goes to the body because you're eating something nice. So whenever there's some pleasure to be had through the body, the mind goes out to that pleasure, goes out to the body. And the same thing, if you have a pain in the body, it's exactly the same thing. The mind tends to go out to the pain. Why? Because there's a business to be done in the body. There is a problem, and you want to get rid of that problem. The mind, we don't like to have pains, so the mind thinks that there is business there. And this is why we have this idea of the middle way and the two extremes. Because they're not actually extremes, they actually almost come together. Because both of them mean that you are concerned with the body. Too much pleasure, the mind goes out to the pleasure. Too much pain, the mind goes to the pain. And when the body becomes no issue anymore, when it doesn't give you any pleasure, and it doesn't give you any pain, then the body becomes irrelevant, right? There's no interest in the body anymore. Why worry about the body if it doesn't give you anything of interest? And this is what I mean. So when you sit in meditation, what you want to do is you want to get to the point where the body actually becomes irrelevant because it doesn't give you any of these things. There's no pain there, nor is there any indulgence. Well, you're just sitting on your bottom, you can't really indulge very much in that way. Nor is there any indulgence. So you just sit there, and then the body starts. It's almost like it fades away from your mind, from your consciousness, because it is actually quite irrelevant. And this is what I mean by the body disappearing. It's not denying the body, it's treating the body in a nice way. And part of this is your attitude. I mentioned the attitude yesterday in about meditation practice, what your attitude should be like. And I said it last, but your attitude is also important in how you think about your own body, right? So you want to be gentle with yourself. When we talk about gentleness and kindness in Buddhism, it's not just with other people, it's also with ourselves. If you are a hard taskmaster, if you are kind of the disciplinarian, if you are the headmaster of your body, and you say, body, sit still, you know, do what I say, and that's not going to work, because the body is going to become tense, because you are acting in a way that creates tension. It's like you have somebody around you who is very tough, very disciplinarian. You can't relax around them, right? Because it's just hard to relax around people who are too, you know, too harsh or whatever. It's the same thing with your body. You have to learn to be gentle with your own body and to have a sense of metta for it, you know. That's why I said in the meditation yesterday, thank you, body, for all the years of service you have provided to me, doing all the things that I've asked you to do. And when you think like that, you have a sense of gratitude towards your own body. That's when you start to relax, and the body starts to feel at ease. So this is what I mean. It's not denial. It's just getting the body out of the way so we can get on with the meditation. That's what I mean. What happens here is that it's not, as I said yesterday, not just the body that you're getting out of the way. You're actually guiding the mind itself in the right direction, because the mind is becoming more gentle. The mind is relaxing. When the body relaxes, the mind also relaxes. So it's a kind of dual purpose there. Okay. How to forgive? What is a good way to practice forgiveness to yourself and others? Is taking a distance from people who hurt you the best thing to do? It can be. Sometimes you need a bit of distance. Sometimes you need a bit of distance to get clarity. If you are too close to any kind of situation, you don't have enough clarity to see what is right. So if somebody has hurt you very badly, you feel badly hurt by somebody, initially it might be a good idea just to get a bit of separation from that person. Otherwise, it just reminds you, and it's like the wound that never heals, because you keep on stirring it up, so to speak. So yes, sometimes it is good to have a little bit of distance if somebody has hurt you. But like with all things, once you get a bit of distance, you start to get perspective. You start to see things in a new light. And once you start to see things in a new light, forgiveness starts to become possible. Forgiveness is about understanding, basically. There's a French saying which I like to tell people. I don't know if you speak French, but the French saying is tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. Tout comprendre is to understand all, right? Tout comprendre, understand all. Tout pardonner is to forgive all. So if you understand all, you can forgive all. Why? Because once you understand the reason why somebody else did what they did, you understand their background, you understand all the conditions that led them to do this, when you understand the kind of the influences, maybe even from their past lives, whatever it is, once you put it all together, you realize that anybody in that situation would have done the same thing. It's just the conditions, the causes that are forcing the person to do what they have done. It's the habits. It's all the things kind of reacting on that person. Or acting on that person, rather. So, because of that, once you understand, you can forgive. And this is the most important thing, is to, when somebody has done something bad to you, the reason we can't forgive is because we're focusing on ourselves. We think, I am hurt. But actually, focusing on yourself is not all that useful. And the reason for that is because the first thing that is useful here is that remember that the other person, if they really have done something bad, then they are a victim of their own conditioning. We don't really want to do bad things. We don't want to do nasty things against other people. I think all of us, we understand that kindness is equivalent to happiness. If we are kind, it's happy. I think we all understand that. And if we understand that in a deep way, and we're not able to act in a way that leads to our own kindness, in other words, we do bad things, even though we know it's going to be bad for us, then how can you get angry at such a person? They're just deluded, right? They are, again, trapped by the habits. They're trapped by the conditioning of the past, and this conditioning in the past forces them to do things that they know is against their own best interest. You see, you understand what I'm saying here? And once you start to think like that, you think, wow, actually it's sad, isn't it? Here they are, hurting themselves much more than they're hurting me, hurting other people as well, and hurting me, hurting, and all of these things just happen because of this conditioning that we have been through. And once you start to realize that, it doesn't become so hard to forgive anymore. And it starts to take away the focus on yourself. It's the focus on yourself that is the problem. They hurt me, it's unfair, it's bad. That's why you can't forgive. But once you think of the other person instead, and once you think that, understand that they are much greater, they cause much more suffering for themselves than they cause for you, then forgiveness becomes possible. These are some of the ways of thinking. And this is part of the idea in Buddhism of non-self, right? We are not really a self. We are not selves who take charge of our own lives and drive our own lives in a good way. We are more like ships on the ocean without a rudder, without a steering mechanism. And when the wind comes from the north, we go south. When the wind comes from the south, we go north. That's what we are, right? We're just kind of caused by all these things. Once you kind of get your mind a little bit around that, forgiveness becomes much more possible. But first of all, yes, do withdraw a little bit, get a bit of perspective, and then once you get perspective, you can start the forgiveness process. Okay, I hope that helps. Okay, how to explain the benefits of meditation to someone who hasn't tried it? And is against it already. Okay. Are there some proven facts? What happens in our brain, etc.? Thank you. Yes, there is a lot of research these days on the benefits of meditation practice. I think if you go on the internet and you just Google benefits of meditation, you find a massive list comes up of the benefits of meditation. Lots of research has been done, particularly in the US. It has shown how meditation practice actually changes the brain, changes the way we think, changes the wavelengths that we emit from the brain, all these kind of things. How it makes you more compassionate, more peaceful, more kind, all of these things have been studied in quite great detail. Certainly from a scientific perspective, I don't think there is any doubt that meditation works. So just try to Google it and see what happens. But of course, the most important thing is how you feel personally, right? It doesn't matter so much if you see all these experiments. If you still suffer when you meditate, it's not going to help very much. So if you make sure that you have the benefit as well, and that is the most powerful thing here. So, okay. How to practice with fear. Okay. Fear essentially is about the future, right? You're afraid of something in the future. You think that something might happen in the future, something might go wrong, and because of that you are fearful. So it's a focus, it's something about the future. You're thinking about the future being wrong. So one way of practicing with fear is trying to understand why you have fear. What is it that triggers the fear in you? What is the cause? So much in Buddhism is about understanding cause and effect. What is it that drives the defilements of the mind? What is it that drives the fear? What is it that drives the happiness? Everything in Buddhism is causality. Cause and effect, cause and effect. But try to understand yourself. What drives the fear in you? And what you will see is that it is something that you are looking at the future and you are kind of finding, you're looking at the bad possibilities in the future. And because you're looking at the bad possibilities, you're fearful about what might happen to you. And chances are that the reason why you think like that is because of something from the past that has conditioned you to think about the future in a negative way. So if you have fear, you can gradually learn to look at the future in a more positive way. Instead of just thinking about those negative things, once you start to understand what it is that you are, what it is that you have a problem with, you can start to think, but am I really being realistic? And then gradually you start to look at the other side of the coin, and you start to teach yourself to see the the good outcomes in the future, right? What are the good outcomes? There are probably many more good outcomes than there are bad outcomes. So you remember the good outcomes and you focus on those instead. And then you learn to recondition your mind to think in a different way. And this is, again, the point. The point is that because the mind is a conditioned thing, because the mind is just a process which is completely dependent on external things, it means that it can be reconditioned. There's always the possibility of reconditioning the mind. This is a very important thing. If you think that there's a self inside, then the fear might be in the self, right? If the fear is in the self, there's no escape because it's part of you, it's who you are. But if you understand that these things are conditioned phenomena, then there is an escape. So even though it feels like the fear has to be there, even though it feels like the fear is part of you, just like when you get really depressed, right? You get really depressed. You feel that depression, you are depressed, not just a state, you are depressed. And then you commit suicide because you can't see the escape anymore. So, but always this reminding yourself that these are conditioned phenomena that can be changed. And because of that, that gives you the hope that there's a way out of this. You learn to look at things in a new way. You learn to see the good outcomes. And then the fear will gradually decline, and eventually it might even vanish. There's a nice story, but not a story by Ajahn Brahm that he tells. And this is the story about the person who goes to prison. He goes to prison, and when he gets into prison, it is just terrible. The prison, you know, he gets into this kind of concrete cell, this concrete, the roof is concrete. I think here in the Nordic countries, the prisons are really nice, but let's say in the US or something, right? Everything is just concrete everywhere, and there's steel bars in front of you, and steel bars on the windows, and everything is really bad. And then you get depressed, right? You feel depressed because you ended up in prison. You feel really bad about this. And then one day, the prisoner, while he's looking around his prison cell, he sees that down in the corner somewhere, something has been scratched into the wall. So he goes down to have a look. What is it that's scratched into the wall? And what is scratched into the wall, probably by the previous prisoner, is this too will pass. Right? This too will pass. And that is the thing about everything in life. This too will pass. So then this prisoner, he remembers that, and this is what carries him through the sentence. But then he uses that also later on in life, for everything in life, this too will pass. Even when you feel happy, you should think, this too will pass, right? And the reason for that is because sometimes when you feel really happy, everything is going really well, then you kind of grasp onto that, you think, this is me, now I really understood the secret, right? I really got it now, this is it, happiness is mine. No, it ain't. And this is the problem. Then the day comes when it starts to decline again and things go down. Because again, it's just another conditioned state. You identify with, you think that now is yours, but it isn't. So you don't even attach so much to the happiness. And when you don't attach to the happiness, you allow it to decline. Then it's not so much of a problem. And when it bottoms out, it comes up again much faster because you're not so attached to these things. So attaching to things is always a bad idea. And once you can let things go and just allow, go with the flow, so to speak, is a much better way. So with the fear again, understand the causes and then start to recondition yourself. Start to look at the positive possible outcomes for the future. Okay, I've got good news. It's the last one for today. How to structure your daily meditation between concentration meditation, mindfulness and metta. For example, 10 minutes of concentration, 30 minutes of mindfulness and 10 minutes of metta. How would you suggest we practice each in our daily meditation? Okay, I think the first thing is to understand that there isn't really any distinction between these things, right? There's no distinction between mindfulness meditation and concentration meditation. This is a very artificial thing, and it's one of the consequences of how meditation is sometimes taught. We tend to box things in and we say, this is samatha, this is vipassana, this is mindfulness, this is samadhi. It doesn't really work like that. The way that mindfulness and samadhi, concentration here is samadhi, the way that mindfulness and samadhi work in the suttas is that mindfulness is the cause for samadhi. There's a cause and relationship. You have to be mindful first, and only then does samadhi or concentration become possible. They're not alternatives. They are two things that have to work together. So, and the reason for that is you can't just focus on an object without mindfulness. If you focus on it without mindfulness, it means that you're using willpower, you're using force. Mindfulness has to arise first. And once mindfulness is there, then you can start focusing on the object of meditation practice, the breath or whatever it is. And this is why the sequence in which you do things is so important, right? And this is why I say, you sit down, you wait, and you allow mindfulness to establish itself first. And you only focus on the breath when it comes by itself. Right? Mindfulness must come first, then the samadhi becomes possible. So, in your daily life, just do the same procedure every day. Always start off with the body, then go to the, try to be mindful with the present moment, then go with the breath when you're ready. Always do the same procedure. And what you will find is that some days you can go through the first steps very fast, right? Because your mind is in a better shape that day. Other days you go through the first steps very, very slowly. You may not even get beyond the first step, right? But always follow the same procedure so that you know that you are gaining the benefit of that meditation practice. You know, you check yourself to make sure that you are ready for the next day before you actually go there. And if you do the same procedure every day, you will gain the maximum benefit of the meditation. So follow the same procedure. Don't think that these are alternatives. No, they are just different elements of the same continuum. About with metta meditation. Well, metta meditation is, again, I would say combine it with this other meditation. If you want to do metta, it's always good to become a little bit peaceful first of all. So go through a couple of the stages, or one stage at least, so that you feel that really at ease and really at peace. And then you can do some metta meditation. And then when you have done the metta, you can go back again and try to watch the breath. Right? The idea with these things is that they build on each other, they support each other. Metta isn't really any different either, it's just that the object is slightly different. But again, the idea that they all come together and they all build on each other and they all support your practice. So, see what works for you. Do the metta and then see if it's easy to follow the breath afterwards. If it's easier, then it means that the metta is working. You're reducing the defilements in the mind. If it is not easy to watch the breath afterwards, if you don't feel more mindful, if you don't feel that the good states are improving and the bad ones are going down, then perhaps metta is difficult for you, it's harder. But it's good to try, because I think metta is a very important part of the practice. It's good to try. What I would recommend you to do is to get a nice recording of somebody you like who does a guided metta meditation and listen to that while you do it. Because it gets you in the mood, right? If somebody says these things in a nice way, it gets you in the mood. Sometimes it's hard to get into the mood by yourself. But somebody there who can guide you can often be much more powerful. So maybe we can do a bit of metta meditation tomorrow morning. Maybe get some instructions tomorrow morning perhaps. First thing, that might be a good idea. So remember that the difference between meditation in daily life and meditation on a retreat is that in daily life you cannot expect to go as deeply as you do on a retreat. So in daily life, do it, but do it so that you do it as a support for your ordinary life. Do it as a support for your kindness and for your goodness, you know. So you meditate in the morning to feel a bit more peaceful. Then when you go to work, you have more time for the people around you. Do a bit of metta so you have more kindness in your daily life. And if you meditate in this way, it doesn't matter so much how long you do it. Do whatever feels good for you. If you can only do 10 minutes, that's fine. Do only 10 minutes. If you can do more, that's of course good too. Whatever you do, but do something which supports your virtue and your kindness in daily life. If you feel more at ease and more relaxed when you go out to meet people at work or wherever it is, then it's much easier to sustain being kind and being good, because the foundation is already there.